If you think of your life as a series of births, what changes? The first birth is when you arrive as a wet, wiggling newborn. But there may be other transitions in your life that feel just as difficult and profound. Some people actually call those passages rebirth. So why does the birth metaphor matter? Let's start with the real thing. Childbirth.
It was the first time when I found that I had to be skeptical of what a doctor was telling me.
This is Ina Mae Gaskin.
When I told the doctor 1 week before I actually went into labor, oh, by the way, I don't want any medication. He said, oh, no, no, no. We're going to have a forceps delivery.
It was the 1960s. Delivery with anesthesia and forceps was standard practice.
Now, I had a master's degree in English, and that means you've read a lot of English novels, and the forceps stories in those novels are not pretty. My major strategy was I'll be really quiet, and then they won't make me do it. I was wrong about that. They did leave me alone for a long time. Then they came in, and they had masks on, and they did what they wanted to do with me, and I didn't have any fight in me. I hadn't realized that I would have had to, you know, freak out and slug somebody. So I did have the forceps delivery, and I had the long separation with my baby, and that's what really made me know that there was something wrong here.
Ina Mae Gaskin went on to transform the way women in America give birth. She started the modern midwifery movement, which gave women a lot more choice in terms of how and where to have a baby. But some things didn't change. When I gave birth the first time, it was years and years later, it was still in a hospital. My water broke, but labor hadn't started. And when I went in to be checked, they told me I could spend the night, but if contractions hadn't started by morning, they'd induce. I didn't have a choice. And the thing about induced labor is that the contractions are much more intense. It was brutal for me and for my daughter. She was born in some distress and with the umbilical cord wrapped around her neck. And maybe that would have happened anyway, and things turned out okay, but it wasn't the experience any of us really wanted.
That story holds true for, if not a majority of American women, certainly a large, large number. You know, we don't have horror stories, perhaps, but it's only in retrospect that we realize things could have gone differently and we weren't given a choice.
This is historian Wendy Klein. She's the author of Coming Home, A Definitive New History of Medicine and Midwives. And she says the history of birth in America is the story of the medical establishment's deliberate and successful suppression of midwives. Now, for her, as for most mothers, it's a story that's both political and personal.
Well, that's really interesting because mine are quite similar. In both instances, with my son and then my daughter, my water broke before I went into labor.
Huh.
But unlike you, I was not told that I was given Pitocin. They just put it into my IV drip without telling me. And it was my husband who noticed it was there. We were literally not informed or given any kind of say.
So I think that ours were fairly average experiences of hospital births. But since then, the number of women who die from giving birth in the U.S. has gone up. I mean, we have all the medical technology and the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and we're failing at something as universal as birth. Why?
It doesn't make sense. It's the most expensive place in the world to give birth. And one would assume, well, if it's expensive, then it must be safe. And in fact, it's not at all. The statistics are horrific in terms of both infant and maternal mortality, and they've gotten worse. Over the past 25 years, maternal mortality has doubled.
Wow.
there is more concern and lots of theories as to why that is. But the risk of over-intervention in a hospital for a low-risk birth can outweigh the risk of under-intervention out of the hospital. The cascade of interventions that happen once you and I enter with just, you know, our water breaking and then the Pitocin and speeding up labor and the chances of that leading to a cesarean section, which of course is riskier than a vaginal birth.
Well, you've spent years studying home birth and midwifery. Is it possible to say that if the U.S. had integrated midwifery into the healthcare system, would fewer women and babies die?
Recent studies have shown that to be true. In states in which midwifery care is better integrated into the healthcare system, maternal and infant mortality rates are better. That's the other thing that makes the U.S. really unique. Midwives deliver about 10% of all babies born in the U.S., but that's nothing compared to, say, the U.K., where it's more like 50%. And to understand it, you really have to look at the history, the way in which midwifery as a profession was virtually eliminated in the U.S., whereas in other countries, it was fully integrated into healthcare systems. And so you don't have that enormous gap for decades that happened in the U.S.
Yeah, let's talk about that. First of all, when did midwifery become illegal here?
Basically, starting in the 19-teens, really 1920s, obstetrics really takes over childbirth. And then childbirth moves into the hospital. The states start cracking down and regulating and removing licensure of midwives.
How much of this is gendered, do you think? Because it's hard for me not to see this as a story of male doctors taking over what used to be a women-run area.
Sure. And that helps explain why it's really in the late 1960s and the 1970s with the feminist movement that this begins to change. That's when you start seeing women say, this is, you know, we're being treated poorly in the hospitals. You have these horror stories of women being strapped down and yelled at in delivery rooms. So there's a pushback. And part of that is to say, you know what? We don't have to do this in a hospital and we don't have to do it with a doctor. And the doctor doesn't have to be male. Let's question this whole model.
So this was the period of the hippie midwives, you know, who were giving birth on communes and in buses. You talked with and met some of those pioneers. Can you put Ina May Gaskin in perspective? What did she change?
Well, she, if anyone has heard of a midwife in the U.S., it's usually Ina May Gaskin. She deserves a lot of credit for waking this country up in terms of recognizing there are different ways to do things. And the fact that some of her techniques, the Gaskin maneuver, some of the things that doctors were struggling with in hospitals in terms of avoiding episiotomies or C-sections.
What's the Gaskin maneuver?
Oh, basically, it was just to turn a woman over to avoid shoulder dystocia.
What's shoulder dystocia?
Sorry. Shoulder dystocia is when basically a baby shoulder gets stuck coming out. The baby's shoulder is sort of jammed and it can be a real emergency. But Ina May Gaskin promoted, and I believe she learned this from a Guatemalan midwife, that if you put a woman on her hands and knees, oftentimes the baby will rotate in such a way that you can avoid a real conflict. That's what that procedure became known in medical schools.
There's one story you tell in the book, and for me, it's an illustration of just how powerful the pushback against home births and midwifery has been. And that's the story of the 1974 Santa Cruz birth bust. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. And in fact, when I first learned it, that's when I sort of knew I wanted to write this book, because it captures so much of the tension that's taking place in 1970s California and other areas. But basically, in Santa Cruz, they had kind of a home underground home birth network going, where they had a clinic in which women could come in for prenatal care, but then these midwives would deliver their children, their babies at home. And one of their clients was ostensibly interested in a home birth. It turned out that she was working undercover for the government. She did happen to be pregnant.
Wait, this is a pregnant FBI agent?
Well, it's not FBI, but she worked for the state.
So a pregnant woman turns out to be going undercover and entraps the midwives?
Yeah. So they receive a phone call one day from supposedly from her husband, who says his wife has gone into labor. Kate Boland, who the case really centers around her, she stays at the birth center treating her patients, and two others go out to this cabin. And they walk in the cabin and they see there's no sign of a woman anywhere. They put down their birth kits. Linda Bennett opens the cupboards. There's no food in there. She opens the fridge, nothing. And then she goes to the bed and she finds it's short-sheeted and gets really suspicious. And then all of a sudden, there's a knock on the door and these cops jump in and arrest them for practicing medicine without a license. They get carted off to jail, and Kate Boland, who has no idea that's going on, she's at the birth center. It's clinic day. There's moms and babies and pregnant women. And all of a sudden, seven or eight cop cars pull up and they raid the birth center. And what they take as evidence is things like surgical gloves, clamps, anything that indicates that she's practicing medicine, which is a violation of the business and professional code. And this case goes all the way to the state Supreme Court, takes 2 years. And at the end, they determine that, in fact, they cannot practice midwifery because they are not licensed to do so.
So they lost.
They lost, but in some ways, that was really a pivotal moment for midwives. It galvanized the movement to kind of come forward and say, this is ridiculous. So there's the coverage in the Rolling Stone magazine. The feminist attorney herself, Anne Flower Cummings, is pregnant during the trial. Kate Boland is pregnant. She has that baby at home in the middle of this case. So it generates a lot of interest and debate about the true meaning of birth and who should be allowed to do it and where it should be taking place.
Are there lessons in this particular story that have something to say to our other contemporary arguments about women's bodies and women's reproductive rights?
One of the things that's fascinating about the Boland case, the ACLU files a brief attempting to support the midwives and say, well, listen, Roe versus Wade suggests that women has a right to privacy, and we think this case falls under that right to privacy, and we should consider this in, within the larger context of Roe versus Wade. The state comes back and says, no. In fact, Roe versus Wade does the opposite. The state has a vested interest in the fetus after that first trimester. Mm. And therefore, we're going to use Roe versus Wade to point out that a woman should not have a choice at the end of the day where she delivers her baby, or who delivers it for her, I should say. So here's a case in which it pits pro-choice activists sort of against home birth advocates, because the home birth advocates have to turn around and say, well, no. Listen, if, you know, we're not advocating abortion here, we're essentially pronatal. Mm-hmm. And if you should pick anyone's side here, it should be ours, because we're celebrating life. They're all sort of pushing for the same thing, which is for women to have a choice and some control of her body. And it ends up sort of undermining them. The other thing it does, by forcing these women to say, well, we're not practicing medicine, that created this huge divide between doctors and midwives. And that, in turn, results in less ability to have collaboration, which is, at the end of the day, what we need.
Yeah. So in the end, right now, 10% of babies in the U.S. are delivered by midwives. What would it take to change that?
Oh, that's a big question. I think it's beginning to change. I really do. And I think midwives themselves are recognizing ways to sort of educate the general public on, you know, what is a midwife? Who is a midwife? What is a midwife? There's still people today that don't realize they exist. They assume it's a 17th or 18th century concept, or it's just a show on the BBC. And to encourage pre-med programs and colleges to educate young people about that as a viable option. I always talk about it in my classes, and they're like, oh my gosh, that's what I want to do. How come I didn't know about this?
Wendy Klein chairs the History of Medicine Department at Purdue University. Keep an eye out for her book, Coming Home, how midwives changed birth.